At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Yes, Microsoft does have boatloads of cash, but still, $8.5 billion to buy a company that has no profits? Whatever do they see in Skype? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by CSX, transporting 2 billion pounds of goods to market by train and working to help move the economy forward. CSX, how tomorrow moves. And by Ally Bank, offering sleeping money alerts to notify customers when their money could be doing more. Learn more at allybank.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. Good to have you with us on this Tuesday, everybody. It's the 10th of May today. And if you own a computer, especially if you've been overseas, you're probably familiar with Skype. You can make phone calls, you can video chat online, and you can usually do it for nothing. The $8.5 billion that Microsoft is spending to buy Skype will be their biggest purchase ever. But the whole thing does leave this one nagging question. How's Microsoft going to get its money's worth? Marketplace's Steve Henn reports.
Skype has 170 million loyal users, and many of them seem worried that Microsoft's about to come in and screw things up.
Well, I think in the near term, I think they should do absolutely nothing.
Peter Falvey's a tech analyst at Morgan Keegan.
They should allay some of the fears that the consumers will have that Microsoft's going to instantaneously come along and start charging for everything and change what people have loved about Skype.
Here's what they love. Skype lets you chat with your grandparents in Akron while you're trekking in Timbuktu. It lets soldiers in war zones watch their children being born, and it's all free. Today at a press conference, Microsoft's Steve Ballmer said none of that will change.
Fundamentally, part of our strategy here is to build and grow the Skype brand.
Ballmer wants to bake Skype into a whole range of Microsoft products, from Windows Phone to MS Office to Xbox and Kinect. Tony Bates is Skype's CEO.
We believe that this is a platform and a set of services that can reach everyone on the planet.
But it's also a business, and one that so far has failed to make a profit. Microsoft is hoping to help Skype reach hundreds of millions of new customers, sell interactive ads, and create new services that consumers and businesses will actually pay for. Peter Falvey is only cautiously optimistic.
You know, not many people will say they love their Microsoft-oriented products.
But he says if buying Skype helps Microsoft build something consumers actually desire, then this deal could be worth every penny. In Silicon Valley, I'm Steve Henn for Marketplace.
The ratings agency Standard & Poor's is doing that thing it does to sovereign debt, European sovereign debt specifically. S&P has once again cut its credit rating on Greek government bonds. Greek debt is now six notches deep down in junk bond territory. There is no small amount of talk that Athens is going to need yet another bailout from the European Union. It would be its second, and that might not be the end of it. From the European desk in London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard has more.
Greece has received $158 billion in bailout loans. Now we're told the country needs another $86 billion. But a leading European economist says even this enormous sum won't be enough. David McWilliams, a former official in the Irish Central Bank, says Greece just can't pay its debts. Default is inevitable.
There has never been, ever been in the history of monetary economics, a country that has got out of a massive debt-stroke-banking crisis without a default.
The trouble is, if Greece defaults or renegotiates its debt, other heavily indebted countries linked together in the eurozone will likely follow suit. Here's Andrew Hilton of the CSFI think tank.
The Irish will demand the same, and they'll probably get it. And then the Portuguese will demand the same, and they'll probably get it. So there will be rolling defaults, rolling reschedulings, rolling rearrangements, you can call them what you will.
And that could mean huge losses for European banks. In this climate of fear and confusion, one report suggested that Greece may pull out of the euro. But Martina Stevis of the Greek newspaper Eleftherotypia says that would be financial suicide for Greece.
Consumers like you and me would rush to ATMs to get their money out before the country converted back to the old currency, which is the drachma. That would probably mean a collapse of the domestic financial sector and banking sector.
In fact, she says this grim possibility may have been floated to make a second bailout for Greece or even a default sound positively appealing. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
In Japan today, Prime Minister Naoto Kan moved his country firmly away from nuclear power. Kan said he's scrapping plans to build new reactors, enough reactors that would have gotten nuclear to be as much as 50% of Japan's total power supply. Instead, there's going to be an emphasis on renewables and conservation. So, from the Marketplace Sustainability Desk, Scott Tong reports.
Japan's plans for 14 new nuclear plants just went kaput. The prime minister said it's back to the drawing board for energy policy. Robert Alvarez is with the Institute for Policy Studies.
This pretty much marks the end of Japan's romance with the atom.
They had been lovers. 30% of Japan's energy comes from nuclear and was on its way to 50. Now, Alvarez thinks even the old plants
will be eventually closed and Japan will move on to other energy sources.
Exactly which sources, natural gas, coal, renewables, is unclear. But not everyone sees a Japanese U-turn coming. The reassessment hasn't started yet, and this could be a ploy from an unpopular politician. At the very least, it's a pause. Economist Arthur Alexander at Georgetown says ever since OPEC's oil embargoes of the 70s, Japan has looked for domestic energy supplies.
Nuclear power looked like the way to go because you become geographically independent of other sources. That has been the direction.
Sheila Smith at the Council on Foreign Relations thinks every country, the U.S., China, Germany, France, will watch Japan's nuclear rethink closely. And in the end, it could benefit Japanese companies.
The industry experts in Japan are going to be leading a lot of this conversation on safety. So to the extent to which you have improvements upon design, you'll have Japanese companies at the forefront of that learning process.
Only a few firms make nuclear energy containment vessels. Most are Japanese. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Traders on Wall Street today were lovers, not fighters. It'll be the happy music when we do the numbers. President Obama went to El Paso, Texas. Today he was talking immigration. The White House is trying to pressure Congress into taking up immigration reform once again. House Republican leaders are lukewarm to that idea, so states have begun taking things into their own hands. There's the controversial law in Arizona that's tied up in the courts. Utah's version of that law goes into effect today. But lawmakers in Illinois are considering a bill that may actually attract undocumented immigrants. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler has that story.
Illinois has its own version of the DREAM Act. State Senator John Cullerton sponsored the bill.
This is a bill that would make college education easier for immigrant children by allowing them to participate in our two college savings programs.
What would it cost the state?
That's the beauty. It costs nothing of the state. There's no state tax dollars involved, and that's why we've got a bipartisan support.
A commission would solicit private donations to help kids pay for college. Chicago Mayor-elect Rahm Emanuel and other state politicians have promised to raise funds for the program. That's important, says Joshua Hoyt, executive director of the Illinois Coalition for Immigrant and Refugee Rights.
The cost of education is very high, and undocumented students cannot access Pell grants or loans because those taxpayer money.
Illinois is also changing the way state law enforcement interacts with the federal government on immigration issues. The governor announced last week that the state would no longer participate in the federal Secure Communities program. It was supposed to target immigrants who are hardcore felons. Hoyt says the federal program has spun out of control.
Rather than focusing on dangerous criminals, they're deporting groundskeepers and nannies.
Some law enforcement officials don't like the Secure Communities program either. Mark Curran is sheriff of Lake County, Illinois. His resources are less than limited.
We don't have the money to build a new jail at this point.
Already, he's got too many prisoners and not enough beds. So Curran resents it when federal immigration agents use one of his jail cells to house an undocumented immigrant.
It hurts us in terms of keeping serious people behind bars if ICE has a hold on somebody because they have a minor traffic offense.
Lawmakers in California and other states are also rethinking their participation in the Secure Communities program. As for the Illinois Dream Act, the bill is expected to pass in the House. After that, it moves to the governor, who has pledged to sign the bill into law. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
You know how we've been talking about inflation lately? How, yes, apart from gas and food, there really isn't any? There's something similar happening in a lot of developing economies. Egypt released its inflation figures today, better than 12% overall, led by sharply higher costs for food. It's a sign, analysts say, that some of the economic pressures that led to the protests in Tahrir Square in January and February are still there. Rising prices was one of those factors. Not enough jobs was and is another one, because if things have calmed down in Cairo, foreign workers who left have started to go back. Julia Simon reports now from Cairo.
A group of workers sew mini fleece children's sweaters at a garment factory in Cairo. Imad Mahdi is the general manager.
All the work made here goes to America, 100% of it.
This is the Maser Taiwan Garment Factory. Taiwan because one of the owners is Taiwanese. The majority of the 550 employees here are Egyptian, but there are also many foreign workers, including Ansur Rahman. He makes a shirt on the sewing machine. He's been an employee at the factory for 3 years.
I am from Bangladesh, Dhaka.
Rahman's one of the 32 Bangladeshis at the factory. There are no official numbers for how many foreigners have jobs in Egypt, but every day at a government building in Cairo, groups of foreigners come to get work papers. Like these two Nigerians. Permits for foreign workers in Egypt is a shady business. It often involves bribery and paying people under the table. Salama Megahed is an immigration lawyer I met during this story, and he asked if I could help find him a maid. I've lived in Indonesia.
Indonesian girl?
Indonesian girl?
Yeah.
I don't know any. I mean, I know them, but why do you need them?
Because I need one girl to serve in home.
Do you have visas for them?
Yes, I can do.
You can get visas?
Yes, I can do. If you can repair 10 or 20 or 100, okay.
100?
Yes, or 200, there's no problem.
The new Egyptian government sees this as a problem. They want to crack down on the number of foreign workers in Egypt. Ahmed El-Barai is the new Minister for Manpower and Immigration, and he says the country is going to start enforcing rules that the old government used to ignore.
First rule is that you can't employ a foreigner when you could hire an Egyptian. Second rule is that if you employ a foreign worker, you have to train two Egyptians.
The minister says that with Egypt's unemployment figures, officially at 10%, but unofficially much higher, it doesn't make any sense to employ foreigners.
We have now such a high rate of unemployment. If we open the door to foreign workers, we are only going to make it worse.
But workers at Maser Taiwan log more than 60 hours a week and tend to only make between $120 and $150 a month. General Manager Imad Mahdi says that higher wages are critical, but he says the government needs to focus on another pressing problem, fixing the bribery and embezzlement that often happens in the Egyptian workplace.
The corruption is the number one problem. It's everywhere. The problem isn't the foreign workers.
And Imad says you can't just blame foreigners for local corruption. In Cairo, I'm Julia Simon for Marketplace.
Coming up, British drivers beware, you're being watched.
So they can put their car there with their camera on board, and if you don't take a left-hand turn, you get a £120 fine in the post.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials picked up 0.6% today, about 75 points, closed at 12,760. The blue chips did. The NASDAQ advanced 1%, 28 points, 2871, the number you're looking for there. The S&P 500 climbed 0.8%, 10 points. Finished at 1357. The Microsoft Skype deal we told you about made a lot of investors happy. They think it means more tech deals are on the way. But Microsoft shareholders were not quite so excited. The software company stock was off 0.2%. eBay, which owns a piece of Skype, was up nearly 2.5% today. Google and Apple also gained. Financial firms had a decent day today. Morgan Stanley banked 1.5%. Bank of America added about 0.8%. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 3.21%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Every 2 weeks, Freakonomics brings something special to Marketplace.
You sent me $5, man.
Wasn't that nice of me? Yeah.
That was nice. Should I open this?
If you dare, open it.
Oh, I hate you.
Join us as we unwrap little surprises. You'll be all the richer.
I kept the $5, by the way, from the lottery thing.
I've noticed.
All right.
Freakonomics Radio is supported by Reputation.com, monitoring, protecting, and improving reputations online while deleting personal data from the Internet. Reputation.com. Marketplace is supported by Cargill, working with customers around the world to connect ideas to opportunities across food, agriculture, finance, and industry. Information at Cargill.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Farmers Insurance, trained local agents committed to small business success. More at 1-866-200-4BIZ. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
Datebook, here's a look at events for Wednesday. The U.S.-China Economic and Security Review Commission holds a hearing on China's space programs. Engineers from College Park, Maryland will try to break the world's record for flight of a human-powered helicopter. And in 1954, Bill Haley and his Comets released Rock Around the Clock, the first rock and roll album to reach number one on the Billboard charts. I'm Alexis Diao.
This is Marketplace from APM. That's American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. The Speaker of the House, John Boehner, went to Wall Street last night. He gave a speech to the Economic Club of New York. It was a line in the negotiating sand on the upcoming budget talks. Down in Washington today, Vice President Biden and the Secretary of the Treasury met with other members of Congress to lay the groundwork for some kind of deal, eventually. But really what we're in for is a long, hot summer of back and forth over what has to happen to keep the government from defaulting on its debt. The most recent deadline I've seen is August the 2nd. But there is a move afoot to take those tough spending and taxing decisions out of congressional hands. Our Washington Bureau Chief John Dimsdale has that story.
In his 1950s TV show, cowboy Roy Rogers knew he could always count on his faithful Palomino to get him out of a jam. Now, folks in Washington are pinning their hopes on a different kind of horse, a budget trigger. It works like this. If Congress doesn't start drying up the red ink, a trigger would force automatic spending cuts and tax increases. Alice Rivlin served on three different deficit commissions that recommended triggers, and she's a big fan.
It's a forcing mechanism. It's a sword of Damocles hanging over the head of the Congress. If you don't do this, then some quite arbitrary cuts and tax increases will ensue.
For example, if government debt doesn't start falling in the next few years, President Obama proposes automatic across-the-board spending cuts and to trim some tax deductions. The president calls his trigger fail-safe, but budget analyst Stanley Collender at Corvus Communications is skeptical.
First of all, you've got to understand, we're not really talking about triggers, we're talking about silver bullets. People are looking for a painless way somehow that will just fix the problem, create a solution.
Collender says triggers in the past have only worked for a short time. For example, a trigger-packing deficit law in the 1980s, called Graham-Rudman, did cut the deficit by $20 billion the first year. But as the deficit grew and budget cuts started to bite, people found ways around the law.
And that's the problem. You can't bind a future Congress, and it's almost impossible to prevent members of Congress from thinking creatively to get around the rules.
And the trigger itself may be against the rules, says former Bush 1 Treasury official Bruce Bartlett.
I also think it's fundamentally undemocratic. We elect members of Congress to make these decisions, and I don't think people like having government on automatic pilot.
But Alice Rivlin says if the trigger needs supermajorities to override it, it could do the trick.
The advantage of a trigger is if you have a very hard decision and you can't resolve it immediately, then something quite drastic will happen. So we better work on something we actually agree on between now and then.
And since this ain't necessarily a happy Hollywood ending,
King of the Cowboys, Trigger his golden Palomino.
It may or may not save the day. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
We'll take a quick pivot here from one crisis to another, budget to housing. The heyday of no money down, no doc mortgages may be behind us, but that doesn't mean real estate is completely above board. In fact, fraud is a bigger problem than ever. The Treasury Department says suspected mortgage fraud hit an all-time high in 2010. You've heard of house flipping? Well, the stuck-in-the-mud housing market has spawned a crime that is being called house flopping, as Marketplace's Stacey Vanek Smith reports.
The Treasury Department said reports of fraud in the housing market have doubled since 2006, more than 70,000 suspected cases last year. Anne Fulmer is with Interthinks, which helps financial institutions track fraud. She says most of the fraud is happening in places that were hardest hit by the housing crash.
And that's in part because people are trying to get out from underneath mortgage debt.
Fraudsters are charging hefty upfront fees to people who are trying to negotiate lower home payments, says mortgage fraud expert Richard Hager.
Loan modification scams, those are increasing monstrously, maybe 100% per year right now.
Common practices in the bubble days have also changed with the times. Take house flipping. In today's post-bubble market, flopping is the new flipping, says Hager.
Often some real estate professionals will encourage the appraiser to come in low, and then they use the appraisal to convince a seller or the bank to sell the property for way under market value. And then these real estate professionals buy it and turn around the next day and sell it for more.
Scams like these have made banks distrustful of appraisers, says Wharton professor Susan Wachter, and banks own thousands of foreclosed homes that they must sell.
The difficulty of banks to verify that, in fact, they're getting a good offer is, in fact, what's slowing down what might be a good solution.
Wachter expects fraud will keep rising this year and next. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
Even acknowledging the fact that we live in a surveillance society with everything from your cell phone to red light cameras at intersections keeping track of you, British citizens have it worse than most. London alone has more than 7,000 security cameras scattered around the city, keeping an eye on comings and goings. But what started with cameras fixed to lampposts has turned into something else entirely, and it's hitting drivers in London squarely in their wallets. Christopher Worth reports.
Not long ago, Nigel Wise parked his car with two wheels on the curb, thinking it was perfectly legal because he'd seen other cars parked the same way.
So therefore, you know, I thought there's no problem in my doing the same.
But 2 weeks later, he got a ticket in the mail for $165.
I was absolutely shocked. It's just outrageous.
Turns out Wise had joined the ranks of the nearly 190,000 people nabbed last year by the UK's growing fleet of camera cars. Local governments around the country have taken smart cars and other compacts and outfitted them with devices that scan license plates and cameras that rise like a periscope 10 feet into the air. It's a practice Frank Manning of Big Brother Watch finds troubling.
I don't think people like the idea of vehicles driving around with a camera recording them.
His organization filed Freedom of Information requests that found camera cars brought in over $13 million in fines last year.
Road safety seems to be the last thing on their mind, really, and it's scandalous.
And that outrage has given rise to the UK's newest motorcycle gang of sorts. They call themselves No2Mob, which stands for No to Mobile Cameras. And their aim is to thwart those camera cars through a kind of reverse vigilantism.
We're helping people to be proper law-abiding citizens.
That's Colin Thomas, or Coco. About 8 months ago, he and about 40 other bikers started following the camera cars and staking out intersections where they lie in wait for scofflaws. To see this firsthand, I climbed on Coco's back seat to hunt camera cars with a few other bikers.
I thought I saw him pulling away as I came to Clifton Road.
Two pulled up at Clifton Road. One was already parked. The other one's pulled up.
Eventually, we tracked a camera car to a busy corner full of stores and heavy traffic.
We're in Savile Row and Conduit Street in the West End of London.
No2Mob member Steve Brown, a.k.a. Boyo, says the camera cars frequent this corner because drivers going north on Savile Row are only allowed to make a left on Conduit Street.
So they can put their car there with their camera on board, and if you don't take a left-hand turn, you get a £120 fine in the post.
Or about $200. Boyo stands on the curb and holds a sign that says, "Beware, hidden camera." A few minutes later, he runs into the street to stop a scooter from making an illegal right turn.
Scooter man, whoa, there you go. Go that way, good man.
You just saved that guy a lot of money.
Just then, someone walking by gives Boyo a thumbs up.
We do have a very positive effect from, thanks so much, all the best, mate. Take care. From the members of the public, because we're all being used as cash cows, you know, everybody's being, hang on a second, I'm just going to look at this car because she looks like she might.
And he was off into the street again. How much impact is No2Mob having on the revenue camera cars bring in? I put that question to Kieran Fitzall, who helps manage the camera cars for Westminster in the heart of London.
The number of tickets is inconsequential here. If they choose to go out there and alert motorists, then that's helping us. But there are probably far more better things that they can do with their time.
Someone has been making good use of his time. Nigel Wise, who I mentioned earlier, fought his ticket and won. It turns out his town council has been operating its camera cars without proper paperwork from the British government. The question now is whether about $1 million in fines will have to be refunded. In London, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by IBM, working to help mid-sized businesses become the engines of a smarter planet. Learn more at ibm.com/engines. By Manta, connecting millions of small business owners with new customers every day. On the web at manta.com. And by Putnam Investments, committed to helping families across America pursue their college savings goals. On the web at putnam.com/529. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, a quick follow to the news yesterday afternoon that Sheila Bair is going to leave her job running the FDIC this summer. Nothing untoward about that, by the way. Her term is expiring. But it's worth a mention that when she leaves, and as we're trying to figure out exactly what the post-crisis rules and regulations for Wall Street ought to be, five of the top jobs running financial regulatory agencies in the government are going to be empty. Now, for extra credit, can you name them? Send us an email. Let us know. letters@marketplace.org. And with that, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media. Today, the Dow picked up 0.6%, about 75 points. The NASDAQ up 1%, 28 points. The S&P 500 climbed 0.8%, 10 points. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. Also, Doug Krisner this week. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you back here tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.